Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence brief on the war for the free world. A man who has served with considerable distinction in a number of capacities, particularly the kinetic kind of warfare in that battle space, is our first guest. He is retired United States Army Reservist Colonel Lawrence Sellin, a PhD on top of everything else, and the author of an important book on the need for a second American Revolution. And we may get to that, we may not in this particular call, but we're going to talk about something else that he has been focusing in on very helpfully and written about most recently at the Daily Caller, which is the phenomenon of China's insinuation of its military as well as its economic might into a lot of very strategic and sensitive places around the world. And I'm delighted to catch up with the Colonel in Finland, of all places. Colonel Sellin, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, I believe for the first time. It's very good to have you aboard.
Yes, thank you for having me, Frank.
So just set the predicate for this, Colonel, because we're trying to make sense of what the Chinese are up to in a lot of different contexts. But I'm particularly concerned about this so-called One Belt, One Road initiative. And you've made the case that it has an underlying infrastructure in the military domain as well. Talk a little bit about that at the macro level, if you would.
Yes, that's true, Frank. I think it's often good to start at the beginning. It's not news to us that China is seeking global dominance. Now, China has a roadmap for this. And as you said, it's a One Belt, One Road. It's also called the a Belt and Road Initiative that China has. And this is a plan to connect Asia, Europe, the Middle East, and Africa economically to China. And it has a land component and it has a sea component. So we can call this the soft power aspect of the Belt and Road Initiative. But underlying that, there's a hard power component, which is a string of military bases that China is planning from the South China Sea to Africa. And this is mainly along the maritime component. Last year, one of these bases, in fact, it's the first Chinese overseas base, became operational in Djibouti. And as you know, Djibouti is at the entrance of the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. So it's a strategic choke point. Now, back to Pakistan, one of the linchpins of the Belt and Road Initiative is called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Now, this is mainly a transportation network to connect China to Pakistan's Indian Ocean ports of Karachi and Gwadar. Now, in the past year or so, there have been discussions between China and Pakistan about a second military base, which will be located in Pakistan. Now, it was not clear until the end of last year the location of that base. And there were discussions in December that the base would be on the Jiwani Peninsula. Now, the Jiwani Peninsula is just west of that key port of Gwadar near the Iranian border. Now, this is important because the Jiwani base is within reach of the Strait of Hormuz, which is in the Persian Gulf, which, of course, is another choke point. So what concerns me is that originally the upgrade of the Jiwani Airport was Pakistan's responsibility, and that was scheduled to begin in July, but 2 weeks ago, they started work on upgrading that airport. So the schedule has been advanced to establish that Chinese military base on the Jiuani Peninsula.
Yeah. And as you say, the upgrade is for the purpose, it appears, of handling very large Chinese military transport aircraft. And Colonel, you've experienced war firsthand in special forces roles in the United States Army. When you look at these kinds of deployments and infrastructure investments and their proximity to strategic choke points, as we've said, is there any question in your mind that what they intend to do is to use them to project power? And if so, how does it relate to the U.S. facilities in places like Bahrain and Diego Garcia? Are we likely to see this sort of negating, or at least certainly compromising, our ability to exercise influence and, again, project power from those spots?
Oh, you're absolutely right, Frank. The purpose of these is a projection of naval and air power, that is Chinese naval and air power at strategic choke points. And, you know, it's interesting to note that both, even now, the Djibouti base and the planned base on the Jiuani Peninsula in Pakistan will basically block in U.S. bases inside the Persian Gulf and outflank the American base on Diego Garcia. So this is specifically designed to do that.
Let me just mention a couple of the other places where this sort of work is underway, it seems. Obviously, in the South China Sea, we've seen the Chinese creating islands and fortifying them. Panama Canal has Chinese-controlled facilities at both ends. In the Caribbean, they've taken up positions in Cuba and elsewhere. Even the Azores, I'm told, are now being targeted, perhaps by the Chinese, for supplanting a U.S. Air Force base there. And again, Colonel, the point is, as you say, people are probably aware that the Chinese have these ambitions. I fear that what they're not so aware of is the so-called peaceful rise of China argument is being pretty quickly disproven by the increasingly aggressive character of these infrastructure investments and the deployments that flow from them. Are they not?
Well, that's true. It's specifically aggressive. If you look at the pattern is actually the same in how the Chinese operate. They will go into a developing country, which needs money. Now, as you know, the United States usually gives foreign aid in the form of grants, but the Chinese give most of its foreign aid in the form of loans. And what it does is create these debt traps in these developing countries. And it happened in Djibouti. The Chinese now have a 40-year lease on the Pakistani port of Gwadar. The Chinese have just gotten a 99-year lease on the Sri Lankan port of Hambantota, which is now, the speculation is that they're going to create a naval facility in Sri Lanka too. So you can see the pattern of how they're working all over the globe, in fact, as you mentioned, in South America, but in Africa as well, and in a lot of developing areas where they're employing their money to create the conditions where they can not only have economic dominance, but military dominance.
Yeah. My impression is that in addition to the loans, there's also just some direct gifts to certain individuals in prime positions. Corruption, I think, is the term for it. So I think the Chinese are buying goodwill, hearts and minds, as they say, the old-fashioned way.
Well, you're either buying the hearts and minds or they're renting them.
Yes, indeed. And it's translating into, again, a global strategic challenge to the vital interests of the United States. And as you heard from my intro, Colonel Sullen, what I think of as what's left of the free world as well. And this is the sort of thing that I think has made your writings on these subjects extraordinarily valuable. And we appreciate what you're doing at the Daily Caller these days. And I hope that you'll allow us to come to you from time to time for updates on your assessment of this. One of the other plays where the Chinese are active at the moment is, of course, North Korea. I don't know how closely you're following that, but I'd love to pick your brains about the latest developments with breakthroughs on the peace process front with the North Koreans and more. But that's for another day. In the meantime, Colonel Lawrence Sellin, thank you so much for your important service to our country in uniform, as well as that you're rendering these days. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Alan Baker, a man who has had firsthand experience with terrorism at the hands of the Palestinian Authority. That and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, I believe, for the first time by Dr. Alan Bauer. He is an American citizen of Chicago originally, who has made Aliyah to Israel, where he lives with his family. He has a PhD in biochemistry. Dr. Bauer has an experience that I'm anxious to explore with him, painful though I know it is, involving firsthand victimization by the Palestinian terrorists who have been inflicting mayhem and carnage on Israelis for many years now. Dr. Bauer, it is very good of you to take some time. I appreciate you joining us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you very much, Frank, for having me. I appreciate very much you having me on your show.
Let me just ask, as we're talking about the Palestinian Authority, if you could just give us sort of at the 30,000-foot level, what is your experience of the role that the Palestinian Authority, PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, Fatah, whichever brand you want to use, is playing in fomenting and otherwise enabling terrorism?
That's an excellent question. And I think that it really, in the U.S., there's a basic view over the past four administrations that Hamas is bad, as they state they want to wipe out Israel, and they do have done many, many attacks. And Fatah or PA is good. And the long and short is that when you look at the terrorists, you look at the flow of money, weapons, and you look at their own statements and documents that have been captured, the Palestinian Authority is a terrorist organization. I mean, in our case, the guy who blew up was a Palestinian Authority policeman.
Tell us about your case involving a specific attack against you and your family by a Palestinian Authority-enabled terrorist.
Okay, my son and I were walking home on March 21st, 2002. I had an office downtown Jerusalem, and it was a very cold day. We were bundled up, and unbeknownst to me, there was a suicide bomber behind us, and he was a Palestinian policeman. He had been actually in Palestinian jail in Ramallah. He was released by a senior intelligence officer who then supplied him with the bomb.
A senior Palestinian intelligence officer.
That's correct. And actually, it says in the indictments that the bomb came from the office of the Palestinian CIA. And Marwan Barghouti, who is assumed to replace the future leader of the Palestinians, he provided $600 to the cell the day before the attack. So this bomber, young man, who was from Nablus, he was brought downtown by two women who drove him into Jerusalem. They stood back while he made his way deeper into the crowd on King George Street, and he detonated himself. And he blew up right behind us. And I was thrown like a cannonball. I just saw smoke. I didn't hear anything. I just saw smoke on either side of me. And I fell about 15 feet forward. And I got up. My left hand was covered in blood. And so this was the height of the Intifada. So it didn't take very long to figure out what had happened. But I'd been holding my son's hand with my left hand. We were walking home. He was 7 years old then. And I turned around and I did not see him. And so it was all smoke. Nothing was moving. There were bodies. There was debris. So I ran back, and I saw a seven-year-old boy face down on King George Street on the sidewalk. And I picked him up, and I just threw him over my head, and I heard him moaning. And so that's the first inkling I had that he was alive. And so I ran with him in the direction that I'd been thrown, and people started taking care of us. So I went back, got my bag. I saw one person who'd been killed. Three people were killed. A young couple, she was pregnant with twins. They just walked out of an ultrasound appointment when the guy blew up and both were killed. And another fellow who worked in the store, he left for an errand and he never came back. So I called my wife. We had gotten the first ambulance to leave the bombing site. And I had, they put a bandage on my left arm. Our son, they stripped him down to his underwear and everything was fine. From his toes to his head, everything was fine. But then one of the paramedics, he removed a towel from the back of his head and it was soaked in blood. So that was the first inkling that we had that he sustained a brain trauma. And it turned out that the head of a foot had broken the backbone, passed fully through his right brain, and lodged itself in his front cranial bone. So I had two screws go through my left arm. He had this piece of shrapnel go through his brain. And at that point, we started into the new life. Whatever was up to that point was the one part of our life. And from that point forward, like the dude from 9/11, that was it. That was 0 point. And so we were taken to Hadassah Hospital. We both had surgeries. And we started a new life. And about 6 months after the attack, there were reports in the Israeli press who had done this attack. There were three people were killed and 81 were injured. So it was a very large attack. And they were all thoughts of PA people, as I mentioned, a PA policeman, an intelligence officer. So that was our driver to sue the PA. And so we joined 10 other families to sue them in U.S. court.
This is a case known as Sokolow versus PLO. I do want to ask you how your son is doing, but let's just talk a little bit about this case and specifically a shocking development involving the Trump administration's attitude towards it.
So we joined 10 other families, all who had been harmed in Jerusalem during the Second Intifada, and we sued in the Southern District of New York. And that's in 2004. 2015, we actually got to court. And after a 7-week trial, we had a jury verdict that PLO and PA were found guilty of 24 counts. The jury assigned a judgment of $655.5 million. It was trebled. The actual damages were trebled. And it was extraordinary. It was a jury verdict. It took two half days to find the PA and the PLO guilty on everything. And then we found out that the Kerry State Department under President Obama was going to come in on the side of the PLO. They filed a statement of interest saying that if the PLO had to pay these monies, then the PA would go out of business, Hamas would take over, it'd be a disaster. So the judge lowered the appeals bond tremendously. They paid this small bond. They went to appeal, and the Second Circuit in New York said that the PA and PLO had their rights violated. They can't be sued in the U.S. They do not have minimum contacts to be considered to have jurisdiction over them. So the judgment was thrown out. So we took our case to the Supreme Court. We had the entire House of Representatives, 23 sitting senators, and 11 former heads of DOJ and FBI, Department of Justice and the FBI, with amici briefs saying this case has to be heard. It's very important, such as our case, with the entire Anti-Terror Act, as well as the jurisdiction of many, many different U.S. agencies overseas. And so the court asked the Trump administration, what is the opinion of the executive branch? This was in June, and it went on and on. And then last week, the end of February, they filed in the favor of the PLO and the Palestinian Authority. The Supreme Court does not need to hear this case. They bailed out murderers. And several of the people are the plaintiffs in this case. Their children were murdered at the Hebrew University. One fellow, he saw his daughter's hair hanging out of a body bag on TV, and that's how he found out his daughter had been killed. And the Trump administration threw the U.S. lot with these murders, not with American citizens, not with those of us who have gone through hell and back and what we've been through. They just like President Obama, said we're with the terrorists. And I expected more from President Trump, but obviously he thinks just like President Obama, you always have to bail out the PA. Anything you can do to save them, you have to save them. And even if you have to run over a bunch of Americans, you do that too.
Dr. Alan Bauer, this is shocking, to say the least, on so many different levels. We will be following this case very closely, and I can assure you we'll be having additional commentary on what's going on here. I can't imagine that the president actually stands with the Justice Department on this, but we need to find that out. How is your son doing now?
Thank God. We celebrated his 23rd birthday last week. He has a U.S. driver's license, Israeli driver's license. He's a wonderful boy. He flew a plane when we were in Vegas visiting my parents 2 years ago. Thank God, he's amazing. He's amazing. We're so thankful. We're so thankful that he's with us and that he's able to do everything he can do.
Thank you for being with us as well, Dr. Alan Bauer. I appreciate your time, and your suffering is something that must not go unaddressed. God bless you, sir. Next up, we'll speak with Daniel Greenfield. We'll discuss this and more with him right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we are joined by Daniel Greenfield, who is widely covered and followed in his nom de guerre as Sultan Kanish. You can find his columns at Front Page Magazine. He is a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and a man we always relish a chance to talk to on this program. Daniel, welcome back. It's so good to have you. I think for the first time in the new year, so I guess belatedly, Happy New Year. Good to have you with us.
Happy New Year. Hopefully 2018, we're going to continue winning.
Amen. Let me ask you, if I can, speaking of winning, the interview that I just completed with Dr. Alan Bauer concerning a case that is now, I believe, awaiting deliberation by the Supreme Court of the United States, the Sokolov versus PLO. He indicated, Daniel, that the Trump administration has now weighed in support of the Palestinian Authority, which has been convicted of being involved in, numerous terrorist incidents, but this particular case that damaged his son and him, among others, killing several, in fact. What are your thoughts on this and the position, if true, of the Trump administration?
It's unfortunate. In many cases with the Trump administration, we don't really know who's making the decisions, especially on things that operate below the level of President Trump. So there are still sorts of Obama holdovers, and they're just people who are committed to the old way of doing business. And the old way of doing business believes that we must preserve the so-called two-state solution at all costs, which means preserving a terrorist group and preventing any threats to it. In this case, terror victims suing a terrorist group is a threat to the survival of the so-called peace process. Obviously, there's never been a peace process. The terrorist group is actually the threat to peace.
You're, of course, referring to the Palestinian Authority, not that other terrorist group. And I guess that's part of the argument here, too, is that if it's not the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas or somebody like him, it will be Hamas that runs the Palestinian community. Are you persuaded by that argument?
For one thing, the Palestinian Authority in Gaza is already controlled by Hamas. In practice, Hamas won an election. And if Hamas won an election because that's the will of the Palestinian people, so-called, again, then what kind of prospects for peace are there? Since that election was won, there have been no actual legitimate elections held in the Palestinian Authority, which means that Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, Fatah, whatever you want to call them, concede that de facto Hamas has the popular support.
Yeah, unfortunately, what we've been hearing about a peace plan being cooked up by Jared Kushner, I don't know if it's true, but to the extent that it would in fact create a second state on the high ground of the West Bank, including parts of East Jerusalem, it would unquestionably be a mortal threat to Israel. Let me turn to another topic that you've written about recently, Daniel Greenfield, at Front Page Magazine. It's not unrelated to that topic. The Muslim Brotherhood has, as you know, been active in this country, not just in the Palestinian community and, for that matter, elsewhere in the Middle East. You've written rather provocatively that it seems as though Robert Mueller, the special counsel, may be aiding and abetting the Muslim Brotherhood in what you call their war. I certainly remember some of his willful blindness is the most charitable expression for it, back when he was director of the FBI, that gave rise to something called the purge of people who were skeptical of these Sharia supremacists. What do you think is going on at the moment in his current capacity as the special counsel?
So there is an interesting subtext to the investigation, to the eavesdropping efforts against President Trump and his associates. And the subtext is that it involves the United Arab Emirates, which has been engaged in its own struggle with Qatar. Now, that people might be reasonably skeptical of the bona fides of the United Arab Emirates, but Qatar has been pretty plainly the sugar daddy of Hamas, of the Muslim Brotherhood, of groups that are even worse than that in some cases. And they've had a great deal of political influence within the previous administration and within the left in the United States. They've become really the voice of that faction, and they've had a close alliance with Iran that has been developing more and more lately. So part of the pretext for investigating some Trump associates has been eavesdropping on foreign actors. So you needed a foreign actor in place, and it wasn't always Russia. In some cases, it was the United Arab Emirates. And now we're seeing this kind of tussle between Qatar and the United Arab Emirates being rolled into the Mueller investigation, which is extremely troubling because Mueller is, first of all, pursuing the same foreign policy goals as Obama did in backing Qatar over other Arab countries that are hostile to the Muslim Brotherhood.
And Qatar is, of course, one of their principal supporters, right?
Yes. Qatar is funding the Muslim Brotherhood. It has backed the Muslim Brotherhood. Through Al Jazeera, it's advocated their policies, both in the Middle East quite effectively, for example, in Egypt and in the United States, for that matter, where they spent a good deal of money on originating Al Jazeera America as a soft power influencer, particularly in Washington, D.C. So it's very troubling to see the Mueller investigation seemingly advance Qatar's foreign policy goals, which are very hostile to the United States.
Amen. One of the other senior officials in the Trump administration's orbit who has seemingly gotten it wrong on this whole Sharia supremacist business is H.R. McMaster, the president's national security advisor. It's been widely reported of late that he is leaving, thank God, perhaps at the end of this month. Some reports indicate that a fellow by the name of Steve Biegun is being championed by some of the same people who brought us H.R. McMaster, specifically Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, as the guy to replace McMaster. What do we know about Biegun, and would this be an improvement in your judgment, Daniel Greenfield?
It's overall a very strange situation. On domestic policy, President Trump has gotten in his appointees, people who generally share his point of view, who support his policies, and have begun implementing them with very good results. On foreign policy, that hasn't really been the case. The people who have been put in there have been establishment types. Some of them are still Obama holdovers. Others are people who are more associated with a very pro-democracy and appeasing foreign Islamic allies type of mindset. McMaster certainly was the worst of the bunch. His departure would be something very much that would be very much worth celebrating. But unfortunately, he's really changed the face of the National Security Council, protected Obama holdovers, and put in people into places who should never have been in there. His replacement is certainly something to be anticipated. The person they're replacing him with is more of a Russia guy. Biegun is much more focused in the past on Russia, and that certainly reflects the current political mindset here. He doesn't really seem to have that much of a perspective on Islamic terrorism or really even on the Middle East that I could necessarily find. Of course, you know that has one. Largely, when he thinks of the Middle East, it's in terms of Russia. So potentially, this could be an improvement on McMaster, but considering that he comes through Condoleezza Rice, he comes through that entire establishment, I wouldn't see this as a significant improvement. It's basically the same people still running foreign policy, and these are the people who have the same old, outdated perspectives that we need to promote democracy, that we need to work together with our allies in the local region, and basically appease them, do whatever they want, because that will somehow advance our goals, even though in the process during the Bush administration, I mean, we earlier mentioned Hamas. That's very much on Condoleezza Rice's plate. And, you know, after that, she began this process of advancing democracy. Obama administration ramped it up. That was a complete and utter and total disaster. And nobody associated with that should ever be in a position to dictate foreign policy again.
Amen. Daniel, very quickly, could you just say a word about one of the other things that you've written about recently, which is the rather startling admission by Angela Merkel of Germany that there are, in fact, no-go zones in her country?
the media and political activists on the left have been claiming forever that no-go zones are some sort of myth invented by Islamophobes and right-wing extremists and so on and so forth. And now that number of right-wing extremists and Islamophobes apparently includes Angela Merkel of Germany, who pretty plainly admitted that there are, in fact, no-go zones in Germany and that they should not exist. Now, she's just admitting what everybody with any common sense knows, but it's going to make it very hard going forward to deny the obvious, because, in fact, these no-go zones exist. There are areas where the police, where the authorities dare not venture, where Sharia law and Sharia police reign supreme.
Daniel Greenfield, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much. Great to talk with you. I appreciate what you do as Sultan Knish at Front Page Magazine, and, of course, also in your capacity as the Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Bill Marshall joins us. We'll talk about somewhat more on this investigation business, and particularly the interesting involvement of Russians with the Hillary Clinton campaign, Fusion GPS, and the Oars. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's great to have with us Bill Marshall. He is these days a senior investigator at Judicial Watch, an absolutely indispensable public policy watchdog organization. Bill brings to his present capacity some 30 years of work in government, in the intelligence community, as well as in the private sector, conducting investigations of various kinds, and it is serving him very well in his present capacity. As I say, he is, among other things, trying to make sense of what is going on with the myriad official and congressional scrutiny that is being applied to the collusion charges against the Trump administration and what seem to me to be a lot more realistic charges thereof concerning what the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton were up to back in the day with Russians and others. Bill Marshall, thank you so much for joining us and for taking, I hope, a few minutes to help us just sort of calibrate what you're working on at the moment in terms of this larger set of seemingly increasingly complicated and maddeningly confusing charges and countercharges. Welcome back. It's good to have you.
Oh, thanks very much, Frank. Happy to be back and shedding a little light, maybe. You know, as you say, this whole saga is getting so confusing, even for those of us who, you know, who are deeply, you know, involved in trying to parse it all out.
It is. So just try, you know, in a couple of minutes here to explain what it is that you consider to be the most important public policy issue at hand here.
Right. Well, you know, just to sort of at the top, I think that people, I don't think that seeped yet into the American consciousness how serious this conspiracy that involved Hillary Clinton's campaign, the top officials of the Democrat Obama administration, the Fusion GPS smear merchants and their subcontractors like Christopher Steele, how serious this cabal was. I want to go out a little bit on a limb here because it's actually, you know, I like historical parallels. You know, I like to look at our current events in light of what we've been through in our country's history before. You know, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were tried and convicted of treason for passing U.S. atomic secrets to the Soviets, right? And which was an existential external threat to the United States. I would posit that what we are seeing, what is emerging with the Hillary campaign, FBI, DOJ, fusion, collusion, is something that is equally or more serious in terms of the integrity of our republic, the threat it posed domestically to our republic. You know, some people may consider that extreme, but I don't know how else to sort of impress upon people the gravity of what is really emerging here.
Okay, so let's tease that out. And again, our guest is Bill Marshall at Judicial Watch. You've used the term conspiracy and a cabal and collusion with respect to a part of this story that has not been the focus at all, as best I can tell, of Robert Mueller's investigation. It is to varying degrees under scrutiny on Capitol Hill, but it seems only really primarily in the House majority of the Intelligence Committee on the House of Representatives side. To the extent that you at Judicial Watch have been doing what you do brilliantly and necessarily using Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits to enforce them, what is it you're drilling down on as part of trying to get to ground truth on what was going on with respect to this neglected conspiracy, it seems?
Right, exactly. The two lawsuits we've just filed on my FOIA requests relate to communications involving two people who were really at the core of this conspiracy, the Clinton campaign conspiracy. And that would be the former Associate Deputy Attorney General Bruce Orr and his wife, Nellie Orr, who was a Russian expert, a Russian speaker, a Marxist apologist and Stalin apologist, I would add. Diana, I should mention Diana West, wrote a brilliant piece at American Spectator on February 22nd that I commend to everyone, called Nellie Orr, Woman in the Middle, to really get a sense of this woman's background. Okay, she's from the revisionist school of American historians, basically, who was an apologist for the Soviet Union, for the collectivization of agriculture in Ukraine, you know, back in the early 1900s, which led to the deaths of millions of people. She's a Stalin apologist.
A troubling candidate to be involved in this business with the Russians and Fusion GPS, where she worked, and her husband. I mean, this is an extraordinary, you know, web of connections, is it not?
You almost can't get your mind around it. This is like something out of the most sort of fantastical novel anybody could write. So you have Nellie Orr here, who is this Russophile Marxist apologist who is acting as a bridge between Fusion GPS. Remember, she was hired by Fusion, which is this sort of smear merchant, disinformation concocting company that was hired by Hillary Clinton's campaign through the law firm Perkins Coie. So she is hired by Fusion GPS for her Russian expertise in approximately May of 2016. Okay.
At which time her husband was in a senior position at the Department of Justice. I'd be surprised if that wasn't a consideration as well.
Exactly. He was number four in the Justice Department. Now, there's been great work being done by Andrew McCarthy and others sort of looking at what you're suggesting, which is that Nellie Orr was sort of the I think Mark Levin has also said something to the effect that through Nellie Orr, the FISA warrant was paid for, you know, by the Hillary campaign. And, you know, the idea is that essentially, you know, she, through her relationship with the Associate Deputy Attorney General of the Justice Department, was able to feed information from Fusion or disinformation about the Trump campaign and, you know, Trump campaign officials into the Justice Department.
And it seems pretty clear this was, in fact, the pretext upon which the FISA court warrant was issued, and that began the surveillance of individuals associated with the Trump campaign and so on. And Bill Marshall, do you agree with basically the working theory here that all of this was going to come under sort of the cover of, well, a concealment once Hillary Clinton won, that this would never have seen the light of day, that they would have ensured that everyone implicated in it would have gotten away with it. Is that the theory as you see it of how these guys were behaving in such a seemingly really malfeasant way?
Absolutely. I mean, I can't imagine the terror that must have struck the heart of all of these people on election night when Donald Trump, and this is one of the things I like to mention too, the fact that Donald Trump was elected despite this really vast conspiracy. Kind of reminds me of the delusional Hillary Clinton, but I don't know how else to say it.
It's based on your factual, you know, predicate here, not simply your delusions.
Right. You have the most senior officials of the incumbent Democratic administration colluding with their party's presidential nominee's campaign, as well as, of course, the media, which is 90% in lockstep with them, and these outside disinformation outfits like Fusion. You have these forces all arrayed against Donald Trump, and yet he still won the election. I love that. I mean,
it is a triumph of hope over experience and nothing short of a miracle. Bill, there's so much more to talk with you about this. I'm sorry we're out of time for the moment, but I want to get you back soon to continue and to drill down more on what you expect to find as a result of this review, hopefully court-ordered, of the Orr records, Bruce and Nelly both. But keep up the good work. I know you will, my friend, at Judicial Watch, and stay well. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.